Hey, we're still here at George Mason University. I'm here today with Jenna LaRusso from the University of Limerick, who is now currently in Canada. Last time I caught her in Australia, so that's a jet-setting scholar there. Haley Morrison from the University of Alberta, and Ashley Johnson from Queen's University. And we're here to discuss an article titled Scholarship and Grant Writing in Physical Education and Health Education, Top 10 Tips for Graduate Students. And again, I saw this as a Google alert that came up on an article. I felt like this was really, really practical for exactly for graduate students. And I thought that this would be a great podcast to do for grad students to listen to. The article is open access, so you can just go on Google Scholar, type in the title, or go to the link, and you can read it if you want the more step-by-step production there in writing. But welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having us, Risto.
So can you start off by telling us the backstory of this article? Where did this awesome idea of writing these down on paper come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 2014, the three of us actually had just started doctoral programs ourselves. And we were also members of the Physical and Health Education Canada Research Council. And some of us were serving in roles like graduate student representative to that council. So ultimately, at that time, we were looking for some professional learning for ourselves as new doctoral students. But we were also looking to contribute to the council. So we did a little survey of all the members in the council, and we just asked, you know, what are the professional learning topics that you all are interested in? And writing for scholarship and grants for graduate students came up as one of the most desired topics. And from our perspective, it made a lot of sense to us because we knew as students that, you know, you might need funds to pay for your graduate school, you might need funds to conduct your graduate research. You might need funds to think about positioning yourself for like the next step, whether it's like a postdoc or a faculty position. So we thought, for sure, let's do that. So we set out to develop a workshop on writing for scholarship and grants for graduate students to present at the council forum that year. And so key to that was we asked a number of people in the council who had some experience and some success with grant writing to offer some top tips. So we made that into a workshop and then published the top 10 tips. So kind of on that note, I just want to do a big shout out, big thank you to those who contributed. Dr. Doug Gleddy, Loren Sauls, Tim Fletcher, Nancy Francis, Ken Lodwick, Chun Li Liu, Lindsay Klein, Luke Martin, and Lee Schaefer, all great researchers and great people.
Awesome. And I love the format of this. It's very simple to approach. You do it in a top 10 tips. So I guess the logical format of this podcast would be to follow those top 10 tips. And so I guess if we can start off with the tip of being proactive and applying, what are the benefits of applying for funding and things to consider when you're preparing your applications?
Yeah, I think it's really important to start with this one. You know, why are we encouraging you to apply? I think it's not just a matter of whether you're going to be successful or not. In our perspective, developing a funding application can have like a lot of positive side effects, whether it's, you know, helping you to clarify your thinking on your future project, which can be really important at the outset of your doctoral program or at the end of your program when you're thinking about what's next. Also, it can just be helpful in developing your entrepreneurial or impact-focused thinking and writing, which is kind of almost like a different language. So that takes time to learn how to think that way and how to express yourself in that way. Plus, I think if you do get funded, oftentimes the requirements in a project can help you to develop a really good project. So yet you could potentially end up doing some great work because you've planned ahead, you know, how will I communicate this to the public, for example. So on that note, then, if we've convinced you to apply, the next most important thing is, yeah, to be proactive, start early. Sometimes these funding applications can be really lengthy. And even if they're not lengthy, It can take a lot of time to compare, to compile all those various documents you might need. You might need to collect transcripts from your previous universities. You might need to get letters of reference. And so you want to do all of that in advance and not wait to hit submit the day the application closes, because at least in our experience, those portals crash on the last day notoriously. So you really want to avoid your month's worth of work just going out the window because you couldn't hit submit on time.
I submitted a junior senior grant at Cal State Fullerton, which is basically a course release. Spent a lot of time doing it. It was due Friday at 5 p.m. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to turn it in Friday at 1 p.m. It was due Friday at noon. And I missed it by an hour. And I had been working with the grants coordinator person. She had proofread everything. And I was like, I'm going to get this done early. And I was 4 hours early, but also 1 hour late. And I emailed them. I was like, is there any way you're going to accept this? And they're like, you know, the answer is no. Like, there's no way we can accept it because that's the school-wide, university-wide deadline for this. So then I applied the next year because I was still eligible, and I got it. And then I moved to George Mason that year. So I didn't even get to use the course release. But that's what I use that as an example for my students when they're like turning in some important thing late. And I'm like, well, sometimes when you do it late, it just, you don't get it accepted. Yeah. So sad stories. I've learned from my mistakes. I always turn in a day early now. Never wait for the last day.
Learned the hard way. Rest in peace to that application.
Yes. So the second tip is to search high and low when looking for sources of funding. And there's obviously like big time national grants, but there's also a lot of small pockets of very easy to get money if you know who to ask. For teachers, sometimes this is parent-teacher associations or just local community organizations that are just sitting on money, waiting for people to ask them how to spend it. So I guess in addition to the aspects you talk about in the article, can you also elaborate on how many applications would you suggest the person to apply to at a time to not be overwhelmed? And how are they supposed to choose where to even target?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would want to underscore what you mentioned there about the range of opportunities. Don't forget that there might be funding in your department, in your faculty, in your university. Then when we're going outside your university, there might be opportunities from an NGO or a nonprofit or from your regional, national, international government. Like, it's a big world out there. So definitely talk to some people. They can help you get a sense of what's out there, a different pot that you might not be available for, what's a good one to apply for, what that aligns with your work, and what maybe you should avoid. Just on that note, just first thing you should do is check the eligibility criteria. We don't want to get you going on something that you're not eligible for, and those criteria can change all the time. So just keep an eye on that. But I think you raise a really good point around how many should a person apply to at one time to avoid being overwhelmed. I think that's a really personal question. It's going to depend on a number of things. I think if it's your first application, from my perspective, I'd recommend you probably just work on that one. If you're a graduate student, you don't want to derail your graduate study work applying for too many things. And connected to that, I do want to flag, in many cases, you need to have the support of your supervisor. So don't forget to have that conversation at the outset. As for how you choose, I think I'd go back to my point, about talking to people. So your supervisor, the funding officer in your department or your faculty and your peers, these are great sources of advice. In my case, I'll give you a recent example. I was deciding between two opportunities and they offered an identical amount of money, but one application was like way more intensive than the others. And I knew nothing about these two opportunities because they were both European and I'd only recently moved to that context. So I didn't know. So I asked my funding officer and she was like, oh, this one over here, it's way more prestigious. And that's why it's way longer, even though it's the same amount of money as this other one. And she also helped me to see this prestigious one has really firm funding deliverables, for example, in addition. So in my case, I wasn't interested with the prestige, and the more flexible funding deliverables were more attractive to me because this project was just exploratory. Also, the less intensive application was attractive to me because I was applying for other things at the same time. So ultimately, I selected the other one. So talk to people we recommend, especially your funding officers.
Yeah, and I think the funding officers is a great point because for grad students or even early career researchers who are at different universities, the funding officer really guides the vision of that department also. Because when I was at Cal State Fullerton, which is not a research-intensive university, they do a lot of research. Our college did a lot of research and got funding. But, she was pushing me towards these like $5,000 scholarship or grants and, $10,000 grants. And they're long, long, long intensive applications for not a lot of money when the overhead gets taken out and the incidental fees. And, let's say at Mason, if you apply for $10,000, the indirect fees come out, you're left with five. And so there's a huge overhead that gets taken out. But when I came to Mason, they're like, oh, you should be looking at like $50,000, $100,000, $900,000. Like the monetary value that was expected for an assistant professor changed with universities. You're like, why would you waste your time with those small grants? So it's interesting. And I think one of the things when I asked about how many you should take at a time, as a grad student, probably one. You're right. Like, a bad problem to have is getting funded on three grants at the same time. Because how are you going to do those three projects at the same time if you didn't also plan for hiring all these grad students and people to help you out? So lots of details there. The third point is to research and get up to date with the grant you're applying for. Jenna, you talked a little bit about knowing the eligibility criteria and making sure that you're actually eligible and not kicked out the first step. Can you talk a little bit about what that third step is?
Yeah, I'm going to take over. So it's Haley here. So when we're talking about getting to know the actual grants, or in that same regard, kind of the scholarships that might be out there for you, the agencies and your institutions, they often have support for writing scholarships and grants. And because priorities are often changing in the research realm really quickly, the criteria might sometimes shift for that grant. So you may have considered applying for it in your first year when you're writing out, oh, these are all of the grants that exist. However, the following year, some of those key priorities might have shifted, and it might mean that it's not necessarily the best fit for you to apply for it the following year when you were considering it. So you really need to dedicate some time and do your research on the scholarships and grants that you're applying for. My personal first steps after I've outlined all of the applications that I anticipate applying for is to find out from your institution or your colleagues, so fellow graduate students and your supervisor, who has past successful applications or what workshops might be available for you to help you get started on those applications. You don't need to replicate another application. That's not what we're suggesting here. But looking at somebody else's successful application will really help you determine, how to frame yours. So doing your research is seeing successful applications, but it's also helping you prepare how you want to portray your project or your ideas. So for instance, the significance to the field, that's often a common evaluation criteria. So even though applications that you see might have a different topic, such as, the field of anthropology got successful in this one, as a reader, you want to be able to identify the applicant's significance really clearly. So spell it out by reading other applications that are really good, then you have a better idea of how to highlight your own work. And because those priorities are changing regularly from different granting agencies, you really want to know what are their specific targets that you want to hit, so you can tailor your application to make sure that you're not only eligible, but you're the best candidate to receive this funding. So that's really important in our mind for how you approach getting started.
Awesome. Thanks for that. So we've kind of talked about searching for grants and scholarships and making sure that you're aligned with and you can pull off what you're hopefully going to get funded for. So let's shift gears into writing the application. Your fourth tip, and you do these, some of them are like do's and don'ts. So it says do shift writing gears. Can you talk about that fourth one?
Yeah, and I'm surprised that Jenna let me take this tip because I've probably learned all of my writing skill tips throughout the years from her. But thankfully, you know, she was the lead on this paper. So she's drafted it perfectly for me. But when we say shift your writing gears, we really want to point out that writing for scholarships and grants, it's its own game. It's its own style. So the tips that we have are really essential in this component. What we've learned from our own programs and from our colleagues who have contributed to sharing these tips is that you need to focus your writing on that specific application and be very intentional about your writing. So shifting your writing gears will allow you to zone in on how you're writing, what you're writing, and for who you're writing for to make sure that you're on track for a successful application. So specifically in the paper, we highlight start with a clear, powerful statement. You want to hook your audience like you would at the beginning of a presentation, you know, like you're trying to sell something. Or in my own teaching, the beginning of class is always the hook. So you want to focus on that and engage them. You want to make sure that you're avoiding jargon and excessive acronyms and that you use assertive language. This was a big problem of mine when I was doing my graduate program, was assertive language and jargon. You know, I was in a specific field, adapted physical education, adapted physical activity, APA, APE, all of these things, professional development, PD. You know, I'm throwing out acronyms in my writing way too much. But you have to remember who the reviewers or the readers are. So make sure that you actually focus in and explain and don't use those acronyms. You know, you're really clear because you don't want to confuse the person who's going to give you this money. You want to show them that you're confident in your project and that you're clear in your ideas. The next is to use the language of the funders and to be specific with sources. These two tips here, they show that you've done your research and that you've done your homework. And lastly is stringing a line through the beginning to the end. So you want to connect the dots for the reader and showcase that this is a tight, coherent, and an impactful idea that you have, and it deserves to be funded.
Yeah, I love that, using the language of the funder. Like I recently submitted a Fulbright application, which is a big, big, long, intense application. But when I sent it to our Fulbright liaison at Mason, she said, the word ambassador is never inside this application. And all Fulbright applicants or the review board, they look at the person going to that country as an ambassador. And you need to have that word in that application. I would have never known had I not sent it out for a review to somebody who's been on the other side of that board. And so then I went through and changed a lot of, you know, certain parts to blend it in. And you know, she gave me tips like, you know, you never want in these to look at that. There's no knowledge of in that country of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You're not going in there to save the day and we're paying for you to move somewhere. It's you're using the knowledge that's already there to help you grow professionally. And then they might also benefit in these certain ways. And so I think that's big. And, you know, sometimes you're advisor is great for this, and sometimes they have no idea how to help you in that specific language, and it needs to go to somebody outside, especially if you're really well aligned with your advisor's work. Mm-hmm. You know, in a lane, and you need to go outside of that lane to get that proper feedback.
My brother used to review my papers and stuff, and he told me, Haley, hermeneutics doesn't, that word doesn't exist. But you know, you got to really think about who that audience is and in what area. I think with the methodology, it might be a little bit different, but you're right. That language is so important in how you're framing your writing.
And I had the benefit of my wife is a professional editor. She edits books and edits for scholarly journal. So she also co-authored that Fulbright application that I have not heard back from yet. But we put that in together, you know, she went through and she's like, this is not a word you can use in this application. I'm like, thank you.
Appreciate it.
So we're halfway through. Fifth tip has to do with formatting. What are the things to keep in mind regarding the formatting of grant applications?
Yeah, so I want to be honest with you. As a graduate student, you're modifying your research project slightly sometimes for these grants to align with the fit that, you know, that one has. You're not reframing seven different ideas or proposals for each one of these. It's one idea that you have, but you're writing it a little bit differently for the different grants. So once you've maybe have that solid two-page proposal and your summary, that's what you're modifying. But the formatting rules across different agencies and scholarships and grants, they change. So you, if you don't pay attention to what they're asking for in regards to formatting, you might actually miss a chance to be successful. It seems straightforward, but we want to emphasize that you need to take time to follow the rules. And you want to be in the I will be considered pile, not the they didn't follow the format, so you're no longer eligible anymore. If you don't do this, for some of those very competitive awards, then they use that as a filtering system. Just like if you're late, you're not going to get, you know, reviewed. So make sure that you actually take a look at what the formatting criteria are. This is another one of those skills that helps if you're planning to publish your work that you do within your graduate program, because different journals, they have different criteria that you have to follow. So your drafts, they might not actually fit within the format, whether it's word count. You know, those are things you need to consider. You also want to format being mindful of who's reading your work and how many applications that they're reading. If you're jamming a ton of content and not being really specific on the sections by using things like underlining, bold text, or appropriate spacing when it's necessary for that flow, then your ideas can jumble together. You want the reviewer and your readers to be able to logically and clearly read your work without being overwhelmed or having to look too hard to find that you've actually met that evaluation criteria. It's important to spell out what your, you know, thesis statement is when you're writing something, but it's so important to spell out the evaluation criteria that you know that you're being judged on so that they can check off, yep, they've done this, yep, they've done that. And maybe that's by using bold text, maybe that's by using headings. Again, that might change depending on the formatting and the criteria that that agency has provided.
Yeah, there's plenty of reviewers out there that are looking to not do a review based on, oh, they did not have the right headings, disqualified. Whether that's, you know, your first entry into peer review journal and it doesn't meet, it's like, this journal is MLA, not APA, desk reject, you know, like you just kind of waste the time unless you do those extra steps. So let's move to six, which I think is really important. What are the steps to take to sell ourselves and our project in a strong way?
Ashley here, I'm going to jump in and do the next few steps. So I'm sure many people would agree, boasting about ourselves is not really an easy task. So selling yourself in our project, I really do think is one of the most challenging aspects about applying for grants. However, I will say that having colleagues like Jenna and Haley, it is a bit easier as I know they're always in my corner and rooting for me and definitely reassuring the self-doubt when it comes time to list my accomplishments, and indicate why I'm the best fit for a particular opportunity. I've connected with them on numerous occasions to say, should I do this? And I always get a, yes, you should. To be more specific, the steps to sell ourselves in our project for a grant application is to really be explicit about the project's potential significance. So for example, how is your proposed project going to contribute to current public priorities? So we want to see how what you're doing really fits to like the bigger picture. And also, why would you be the right person to conduct the project? So for example, does your proposed work build on some of your previous work and skills? Do you already have an established connection with the community or participants you're looking to work with? So these things really do indicate to a funder that you're capable and ready to start that project immediately. Providing all the key details for your project is also important. Haley mentioned some key things to put in there, but you never want the reviewer to be left with questions after reading your proposal. And then finally, ensuring to outline how your research will have an impact is an important step. So this includes discussing where you intend to disseminate and share your research findings. And I think something that when we're in academia, we don't always consider is the different avenues of both inside and outside academia. So we want to ensure that practitioners and the general public have access to this information as well.
Awesome. So we've kind of gone through the searching for, deciding to apply, then writing that strong application. So logically, we get now to that revision part, which is, again, super important before hitting that submit button. So can you talk about tips 7 and 8, which talk about having people review your paperwork and selecting referees?
For sure. I think first and foremost, for anyone who's listening, the one key thing to take away from this tip should be proofread, proofread, proofread. It sounds so simple, but yet so many of us don't take the time to do it thoroughly. It's also very important to have others review your draft application before submitting. You gave some great examples before. I'm a little jealous that your wife is an editor, but so that's awesome that you have her in your pocket. But you also mentioned
You can only use that occasionally.
Okay.
Because she works for herself. And then if I just send all the stuff over there, then she stopped building her own business. So I'm very careful with which ones I ask for her to do. But any grant application or every job application that I've ever sent out has gone through there. But I dare not send my peer-reviewed papers to her, because then that would be another kerfuffle there. So I just send those to trusted colleagues.
I appreciate that you've outlined who to send what to and that you keep her for special occasions.
Yes, networked, and that the very special ones go there.
Jen and Haley are very much on some of the top of my list of people to ask to review. But you've made that great point about using the language, and if you hadn't had somebody sort of in that niche of that application suggest that you use the word ambassadors, it does make a big difference. So I love that you already highlighted that to ask a diverse group of people to review, not necessarily just academic colleagues. I think also it's, don't be shy to ask friends and colleagues for assistance. We all have, you know, large to-do lists, but I think people are okay with like favor for a favor, but don't be shy, because people can be honest and say they don't have time, but it's better to ask than not, because you really do want that fresh set of eyes on something, because after you've looked at it for hours upon hours, you might miss those key details that you overlook that someone with a fresh set of eyes will be able to see. We also talked a little bit about the diverse set of people looking, because given that most review panels are multidisciplinary, you want to have people from different areas take a look. And then also, you know, Haley mentioned having her brother review and understanding that jargon is sometimes difficult, but getting friends and family outside of academia can really provide that feedback that would be relevant to the general public. So that diverse group is key for reviewing. Our tip 8, as you mentioned, connects to selecting references. Again, asking people to act as a reference is not always an easy task. However, there are some ways you can help them help you. So for example, giving them lots of time before the deadline is so important. Providing ample time will allow them adequate time to write a strong letter and to meet the granting deadlines. As we've heard already, a sad story about not meeting them. A late reference can impact your ability to apply, as most applications are actually considered incomplete unless all components, including reference letters, are submitted. So you don't want a referee not to be able to meet the deadline or run into a challenge last minute that can't be addressed, because it actually could lead to your application being ineligible. So the more time, the better. also from the point of view from being a referee, as I often get asked, one thing I really appreciate is when the applicant highlights the key points from their application documents that they want me to speak to. It first indicates to me that they've considered why I'm a good fit. And also it helps me tailor the reference to the desired area because I don't necessarily know what all the other referees are speaking to. So it's just very helpful to be able to write the letter to be the best reference you can be.
And so we had at ARA, the Invisible College, back in, it was like 2016, Kathy Ennis and Ong Chen ran a session on how to get like NIH, NSF grant funding, which are these big national federal organizations in the U.S. And one of the main things I took from there was that Kathy said, you always write the letter of support for the school district or whoever that your partner is. They can write it themselves, but you say, I have a draft, which is what, so you have all the right things in there. You pre-write it because people are busy, right? If you want to work with a principal and part of your application or your grant funding application is to get a letter of, you know, agreement from a school or a school district, that principal's super busy. It will take them like an hour to write a really good letter. You write it for them and say, feel free to modify this or write your own, but I have done the legwork for you. And then it's like, most of the time they just go in and sign that paper.
Can I add something, Ash? Just was thinking about this and we had this conversation of Jenna mentioned it, your supervisor might be a requirement as a referee too. So you might just be entering your graduate program. It's the first time you've really met them or getting to know them. But some agencies, they want your supervisor to be one of those referees. So that's why what you said there of outlining those components or helping them by drafting up that letter will be really important. But that's something that I know in Canada here, the bigger agencies are looking for. Your supervisor must be one of those reference letters or referees for you.
Another thing about that you wrote in the paper on getting feedback, that feedback has to be constructive and not the nice feedback that you can send to your mom and your mom's like, this is so great. I'm so proud of you. There are no errors in this at all. You should add a period here. You know, like, you need to send them to people who are actually going to give you a thorough review and not be mean, but give you the constructive feedback that you need in order to be successful. And those are sometimes tough edits to get back, but it's way better to get it when it doesn't count and you have time to make those changes. And, you know, you've said a bunch, like giving adequate time, right? If you're going to apply for a grant or scholarship, even if it's an internal scholarship, you have to give several weeks for them to write that letter, right? You can't say, hey, next week on Monday, I have a grant application due. Can you write me a letter of recommendation, right? It's a lot of advisors will do it, but they're annoyed because you're crashing it late. And that's just like, you know, honing those relationships is super important as a grad student. So being respectful, even if it's for your peers, to give them like 2 weeks to get something back. So we've talked about being mindful not to be overwhelmed with applying for a ton of grants at the same time. Tip number 9 brings this up again, but now regarding being truthful to the research agenda and being sure that you're willing to do the work required. Can you expand on that?
For sure. So it can be very tempting to apply for all funding opportunities for the financial return. However, asking yourself if your research aim meets the funder's priorities before applying can really help you stay truthful to your research agenda. We've talked a lot about large tri-council funding, I've also dipped a bit into community-focused grants, which their priorities tend to change, more so than higher university-specific grants, given on the nature of what's happening in health and, like, the public policy. So I think really looking at what your research agenda is compared to what the funding priority is and considering if it's actually a match, and as Haley mentioned, making those small changes to align with the priorities for fit. But if you're having to make drastic changes where your research aim is no longer actually what you're looking to do, it might not be worth applying or for a good fit. And really what I mean by this is the criteria or priorities, or sometimes called themes, that are associated with the funding application really does need to be a good fit with your own research and personal goals. So you want to avoid spinning or changing your research to fit that financial ask. Because if you're successful, you're actually going to be required to do the work that you proposed, which might not be necessarily the work you want to do. So I would say, just simply put, try to avoid following the money rather than your research agenda.
I have another great horror story for you, if I might share. So when I got to Mason, there's no requirement that I have to bring in millions and millions of dollars, but there is kind of an unwritten rule that you have to swing. You have to try to get something. You have to put in some grant applications. So we got a seed grant on integrating STEM into physical education. My plan was to use this like interdisciplinary group. We had a computer science professor, two science professors, physical education professors. We're going to implement this after school STEM and integrate it to my REACH after school program research. When I got to the seed grant, we started working. We did this small module, and then we pitched this national organization, NSF, National Science Foundation, for this $1 million grant. And as we were pitching it and thinking about what we're doing, I was advised more so like, hey, this isn't really enough money to go in and do all this field research. I'm like, $1 million? Like, what do you mean? They're like, well, if you take course releases for all these people and grad students for these things and this, you really should do the first step in working with teachers and do a professional development grant and then build out these modules that we started and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I think that's right. Like, I agree. And then I realize that I'm out of the field. Like, the research that I want to do is with kids, helping kids. And now I'm like doing professional development for teachers in like STEM concepts. And as I got through to the end, I was like, holy crap, like, I'm going to press submit on this and cross my fingers that I don't get funded. Because if I get funded for this, I have to do 3 years of a project that I don't want to do. And it was like, I wasn't strong enough as an academic to know what I wanted to do. I was influenced by people who had gotten big grants. And I was like, yeah, I do need a $1 million grant to be considered a successful academic. And I just went through, and thank God we did not get funded. There was a person that got funded for a very similar research project at Northwestern, because I looked it up later. And they're like doing all this work with kids and working on the dance education program to get these kids in after-school programs to learn STEM. And I'm like, hallelujah, good for them. And from now on, I'm like, I'm not going to put all this effort to get this funding to find that I don't want to do the work. And I think it's hard as a younger academic, because you don't feel confident telling senior scholars that I don't want to do that. You know, too often you just kind of roll in. So I guess I've taken over this in my horror stories.
No, I was just going to say, I don't think I've ever in all my years of grants heard anyone say, thank goodness I didn't get that grant. So I'm just going to like, full props to you on saying that first time ever.
It definitely is like one of those not funded, but goes on my annual review. I went for a $1 million grant, you know, counts for something. So we're now to step 10, which is right around where we go in and click that submit button. What are the things to keep in mind when we get to this last step?
Absolutely. Yeah. At some stage, you just have to realize that you've just given it your best shot. It's never going to be perfect, like nothing is. So at some stage, just hit submit. So at this time, we just really want to encourage you to be persistent. If you get rejected, that same project that was rejected last year might be funded this year by the exact same funder, or even maybe by a different funder. That was my case in my PhD, was rejected the first year and then funded the next year by the same funder. So just don't give up. We also really want to emphasize that yes, these evaluation processes for scholarship and grants are typically a rigorous, try to be objective process, but there's still some subjectivity there. So you can have a really important topic, a really well thought out plan, a really meticulous application, super strong reference letters, fantastic CV that supports the work that's being done, and you can still not be funded. So there is absolutely some luck of the draw involved. We really want you to just keep it in perspective. Don't let a rejection get you down. I saw the other day online, one of my favorite researchers from a different field, from the policy field, he put on his Twitter a screenshot of his funding portal. And so it listed, oftentimes at your university, you'll have one of these where you have to not just submit to the funder, but you have to submit to your university first. Anyways, he had the list of proposals that were, you know, in progress, awarded, rejected, and the number in the rejected line was, you know, over five times more than what was awarded, let's say. So I think just important to say, if you're starting out, remember that even, you know, the top scholars that you look up to, they strike out more times than they hit. And that's just part of it. It's part of learning. It's part of figuring it out. So just stick with it. You don't let it get you down. Just keep moving.
Yeah. And definitely part of it is a numbers game. You got to put in grant applications. Sometimes you get feedback, not all the times, but that work has not gone to nothing. You don't trash your application. You've done a literature review. You've tightened up your sentences. You can copy and paste that into another application that is for the same funder the next year or for a different project. So that work that you're doing is not like, oh, I just wasted 40 hours of my life getting this application in. It's, you know, there's some help that just pushes that for the next one. And I think before we finish up, there's one thing in the article that I don't think we talked about, was going to these open office hours or open seminars for the person who is overseeing the grant, if available. Like for the Fulbright, I went into Q&A sessions, and then there were still questions that I just didn't know if I was eligible. And I requested a 15-minute office hours and realized that there was a portion in my application that would have deemed me unqualified if I would have moved forward, just by my interpretation of the qualifications. So like you wrote in the article, oftentimes the people who are hosting those office hours are the people who do that first review or who are part of the organizing committee, or, you know, for these big national grants, it's super easy to go in and just request a time. Now with Zoom or, you know, Teams, you can just request that 15 minutes. And if you can pitch that project in 15 minutes, at least there's a little memory in that program director's mind that reminds them and says, oh, I remember this project from this thing. And you can kind of have that little in. And I thought that was a great tip that you put into the paper, and I wanted to get that out. But thank you. This has been really, really helpful. I think step-by-step instructions like this can help a lot of people, and there's a lot of tips. And again, like you mentioned, all the scholars that actually gave you this information to write this paper, they have been successful in getting grants. So these are tried and tested methods. I think this is going to be really helpful for grad students and even early career researchers that are trying to figure out what the grant game is all about. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having us.
I really appreciate all your stories. Just solidifies that our tips are important and maybe accurate. So thanks for your personal horror stories too.
Yeah, you should have published this in like 2015, and then I could have taken all those steps and then not made the mistakes that I publicly shared with everybody.
You know how long it takes to get something published. I don't know if it says, but the first call out for these, because this is a series of papers, was we started this back in 2014 when we were, you know, on the beginning of our treks. So yeah, we're hoping to keep them coming, all the tips for grad students that we can. It's a passion project of all of ours.
Yeah, and it's super helpful. And I know that because it's also this journal publishes most of the stuff open access. So it's a great resource for people. You don't have to get through a paywall first in order to learn how to get money to pass that paywall. So thank you so much. I also want to thank Alba Rodriguez for her help in producing the podcast. And for people who are listening to this in the current age, enjoy your winter break or summer break for those in Australia and New Zealand and that part of the world. And thanks for listening.